thank you very much, Neil. That was such a kind introduction. It's great to be here in Santa Cruz. I've been all over California, but this is the first time I've ever been to Santa Cruz. And I am so thrilled to be here. And I intend to come back many times because I like the feel of this town.
Yes.
It's great. Oh, it's great. And thanks to the Raging Grannies. I mean, what wonderful songs that the Raging Grannies sing. And these lyrics that just hit, you know, you just hit it right where it is. I mean, the truth that comes out in these songs is spectacular. And the Grannies are all over, well, I guess they're all over the world, aren't they? We have Grannies everywhere that are the voices of conscience. They're the women who have seen generations of horrors, and they have lived with what's happened to their brothers and sisters, and then their kids, and then their grandkids, and then their great-grandkids. So it's with these voices that really they speak for all of us. So let's have another round of applause for the Grannies. And then for Scott Kennedy and all of the people of the Center for Nonviolence, what a wonderful organization that is, that here in your own community, you have men and women who work tirelessly year after year after year for nonviolence, and that this is a center where men and women of the military can come for aid and assistance to help resolve the issues that they're having in their own minds about whether or not they should either join, or after they've joined the military, should they continue that, or to help them with the dilemmas that always come about when we're in time of war. And then Veterans for Peace, the great Veterans for Peace. It's a wonderful organization. That has so many different projects going on all over the countryside. And we've got veterans of foreign wars that are here right now, and we thank them for being here.
Yay!
Let's see, what other groups? Code Pink Women for Peace, I saw that. Yay! And Wilf is here. Wilf's in the house. Yay! Women in Black. I'm sorry?
Quakers.
Yay, Quakers. Pardon?
UNA,
the United Nations Association. Women in Black.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, how many of you all were at Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. Let's see, what are some of the other groups
Monterey
that are...
Monterey Peace and Justice Center.
Monterey Peace and Justice Center.
Yay.
Direct Action Task Force Against Torture. And Diane mentioned the GI Rights Hotline. And I see Courage to Resist, one of the t-shirts back here, another great, great group that helps with war resistors.
Watsonville Peace and Justice.
Yay. So you all represent tremendous organizations that day after day after day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and hopefully not decade after decade will we have to keep pushing on this particular war, but for the militarism and militarization of our society, I think we will all have to keep working for decade after decade after decade, because it surely seems to me that our country cannot break this cycle, or has chosen not yet to break the cycle of militarism. And that's something I think we all are very concerned about here, otherwise we wouldn't be here. But I want to acknowledge two very important people in this audience who have done a lot of speaking and writing, and one of them is going right back there, Dr. Stephen Nunez, who is one of the great authors. And Elizabeth de la Vega, who's right here, who has written a remarkable book on impeachment. She is a former district attorney, U.S. district attorney, and she used her expertise in a very short amount of time to create what would happen if George Bush were taken to a grand jury. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, Elizabeth and I were together in New York City in an off-Broadway show with the Culture Project about 6 weeks ago. For 4 weeks in a row in New York City in an off-Broadway theater, the issue of impeachment was discussed. Not just discussed, but I mean, there were tremendous presentations each Sunday and Monday night. So when you can get this theme in an off-Broadway venue, I mean, it's picking up steam on accountability. Accountability of crimes that have occurred in our country over the last, you could say centuries, but let's just take the last, 8 years. And that's what really this book of Dissent, Voices of Conscience is all about. The book Voices of Conscience is a compilation of the profiles of about 30 men and women of our government who have spoken out very strongly against the policies of the Bush administration. They have spoken out at great risk to themselves many times. I was one of three U.S. diplomats who resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq before the war started. But the three of us, we gave up our jobs because of our disagreements with the Bush administration, but none of the three of us faced any sort of punitive measures. We were not threatened with going to jail for having spoken out. That's in contrast to what's happened to a lot of other people who have spoken out against torture, against eavesdropping, against secret prisons, against a war of aggression, against, what else? I mean, the list just goes on. I mean, and who would have thought 10 years ago that we would ever be saying this in a meeting, that indeed there were such issues of such as torture, such as causing an illegal war, the invasion and occupation of an oil-rich Muslim Arab country that had not attacked the United States, that our country would now be involved starting its almost the sixth year. It's really the sixth year. We've already completed 5 years in Iraq. We'll be starting the sixth year. If you look at the men that have been in Guantanamo and other secret prisons or secret prisons in throughout the world, people who have just been kidnapped by our country, and that's what it is, it's kidnapping. It's not asking another country through a legal procedure called extradition. It's kidnapping people and then putting a moniker of it of extraordinary rendition. That's kidnapping. Here we are talking about such things, and it just breaks all of our hearts, I think, that our country has come to thinking that the crimes that have been committed really need to be addressed in terms of accountability through, as a minimum, impeachment, and as further on up the scale of people who have been responsible for these actions to be accountable in even further ways to, if not an international criminal court, how about a domestic criminal court? I mean, why leave it to the international community? But that's kind of getting a little bit ahead of the story, because the story that we have in this book is about the men and women who were speaking up, who from their positions within the U.S. government said, something's going wrong here. I'm being asked to commit illegal acts, criminal acts, and I can't do it. I just cannot do it. And I need to tell someone about it. Or they observe something else that was going on that they knew was wrong, and they felt that it was important for them to speak up. There's a woman that's in the news right now, Sybelle Edmonds. Sybelle Edmonds was an FBI translator, hired as a contractor back in 2002. And she was to go through the backlog of tapes that the FBI had that they were supposed to be transcribing to find out what was going on, particularly in tapes that they had gotten from listening to conversations from government officials and people in Turkey and in Iran. Sibel speaks fluent Turkish and Farsi. And after about 6 months, she was fired from her job because she dared speak up to say, my translations are being changed by my supervisor. And my supervisor is also, it appears, having an affair with somebody of interest to the FBI. Well, what happens when you raise these issues higher in your chain of command? One would think that the next supervisor up, the next supervisor would say, uh-oh, boy, this is trouble. We better investigate this because we don't want your translations changed. We want to know, we want the honest truth of what has been said. And if somebody in our organization is having a relationship with someone that we are investigating, we'd better get that stopped. But that didn't happen. Instead, Sibel was fired from her job, and told to keep her mouth shut, because she very quickly went to the Inspector General of the FBI to say, this is going on, and you've got to investigate this. And they said, no, you've got to keep your mouth shut about this. You can't tell anyone what's going on. It's part of your contract. And if you start squealing about things that you've seen, we'll go after you in a court of law. Well, there were ways to get word to the Congress, and the Congress had a couple of closed-door hearings on what Sibel had to say, and they were very concerned about it. And in fact, they pressured the FBI's Inspector General to actually investigate what had happened. And 4 years later, the Inspector General's report came back and said Sibel Edmonds was exactly right. But what has happened in the meantime? Now, I mean, 4 years, she's been fighting this. She's been going to court with them to try to be able to tell her story publicly, to let us, the people, know why she was so concerned about what she had learned. For 4 years, she kept her mouth shut. But now she is defying the U.S. government, and she went to all of the major newspapers of the United States, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, all of them, to say, this is the story I have, and I need help getting it out. Will you publish this? And they all heard her story and went, we can't publish this. So now it's coming out in the London Times. And in fact, last Sunday and this Sunday, you can read an extensive interview with Sibel, who says that she was transcribing tapes that show criminal actions by senior members of our government, to include a senior State Department official who had been giving nuclear secrets to the Turks, who were then passing them on to the Pakistanis, who were passing them on to the Libyans, to anyone for sale, these secrets were. So Sibel Edmonds is, now that this is, yesterday we find that the number three person in the State Department, Nicholas Burns, who has been in charge of the program of the State Department and working with India on the United States is transferring nuclear technology to India. Mm-hmm. This has been a major, major program of great controversy over this last year. Why would the United States be transferring technology to any other country right now, particularly one where India and Pakistan have such a volatile relationship? We've got the Pakistani government that the Bush administration is trying to use in the war on terror, that Musharraf, we've paid him billions of dollars to assist in going after Al-Qaeda in the tribal regions of Pakistan, which has gone nowhere. Pakistan, the country where many of the men who were sold to the United States for being either a Taliban or Al-Qaeda, $5,000 if they were accused of being a Taliban, $25,000 if they were accused of being Al-Qaeda. Most of those people came from Pakistan. They were foreigners living in Pakistan. And it was through the complicity of the Pakistani government that these people were were purchased by the United States. You know, 95% of the people that ended up in Guantanamo were not captured on a field of battle. We purchased them from other people in other parts of the world, most of them from Pakistan. So here you have this Sibel Edmonds, who has finally, she's getting her story out about what she was translating in those tapes. But it doesn't come out in our press, because indeed our media, as you all well know, our media has really let us down. Our media is not covering the stories that we really need to know. I mean, right now, certainly we have a presidential election going on, and we do need to know about where the candidates are and what they're saying to each other and all this sort of stuff. But there are a few other things going on in the world, and particularly the war in Iraq. I mean, that's really become the back page news now. And yet, if you dig around in it, you find that just 2 days ago, 80 people were killed in Iraq. Last week, we had 10 soldiers that were killed in one incident. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that the administration keeps saying, well, the surge is working, the surge is working. The level of violence is getting lower and lower. Well, but when you really start putting together all the independent sources that we have now, and thank God for Democracy Now!, thank God for Dar Jamal, thank God for, you know, the Link TV, Free Speech, all of these organizations, yeah, you all know them, you look at them every single day, because they, the BBC, other, well, Al Jazeera is another one, that if you can get it, it's one to watch, because there are a lot of very interesting programs on that one. But our media has really failed us royally on giving us the information we need to know in order to make really good choices about where we want our country going and who we want leading our country. Well, the media, again, is failing on this issue of Sibel Edmonds. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens to her, whether she is arrested for giving up official secrets of the United States. I mean, she has been warned. She was under court order not to reveal anything. And now she has, because she says it's so important for us to know. You know, it's kind of like dear old Dan Ellsberg, the whistleblower, the fellow who Xeroxed thousands of pieces of paper that turned out to be the Pentagon Papers and were the history of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. And with that documentation that finally, after 3 years, he had it available, and indeed the Washington Post had it, the New York Times had it and would not publish it. And 4 members of Congress had copies of those thousands of pages in their safes in Congress, and they would not bring them out. Until one presidential candidate now, Mike Gravel, he is the one. I mean, for talk about an act of conscience 35 years ago, where a congressman said, whew, I know this is really going to be controversial, but it is important that we get these documents out into the public view so that everyone will know how we got in Vietnam, what's been going on. And so it was Mike Gravel that then released the Pentagon Papers, and then they were picked up. The New York Times pulled theirs out of their safes and then started publishing. Well, in that same way, Sibel Edmonds' revelations of what's been going on nuclear proliferation, I have a sneaking suspicion this is going to be a really big one. Another one that we profile in our book, another person who's taken a great stand of courage, not from our government though, but from the British government. You know, there were 4 times more people who resigned from the British government than the American government in opposition to their governments going to war in Iraq. 4 times more. And one of the people that resigned was Elizabeth Willemshurst. And she was the deputy legal counsel of the British Foreign Service, or the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And she resigned just about the time I did, in March of 2003. Only her resignation letter did not become public. There's more of a tradition of keeping your resignation letters private than there is here. I mean, I was thinking, my God, if I'm going to give up my job, I want everybody to know why I'm giving it up, you know? I think it's important that they know. Well, she kept her resignation letter. The government did not release it, and she did not release it. It came to light, though, when another woman of the British government, Catherine Gunn, who was a young woman in her early 20s, who was working for their equivalent of the National Security Agency, the listeners, you know, the people that listen in through tapping into communications networks. Supposedly, she wasn't tapping into British citizens' stuff. I think they had the same regulations that we supposedly have, that our National Security Agency was not supposed to be tapping in on our conversations. They were supposed to be listening to all the other countries. But now we find out through an AT&T whistleblower just at the end of last year, who finally coughed up the information that for 5 years, the major communications companies of America have been providing to the Bush administration access to cell phones, landlines, emails, anything they wanted, they got. They were approached by the Bush administration, who said, and this approached 5 years ago, the Bush administration said, we know what we're going to be asking you to do is illegal, but, you know, it's for national security, and we really need your help. You know, rather than saying, we are going to be having court-ordered warrants to tap or to listen, eavesdrop on certain people's communication because we feel there is a direct link to them and some terrorist act. That's the way it's normally done. But no, the Bush administration say we know it's illegal to swoop up huge masses amount of information with no restrictions on it. And we know it's illegal and you know it's illegal, but for our own national safety, please do this for us. And all of those communications companies, with the exception of one, and that was Quest. Quest was the one that said, you know it's illegal, we know it's illegal, and we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, the rest of them, though, for 5 years, all of our communications were being funneled into the National Security Agency, which was illegal. Now, what is our very esteemed Congress, what are they considering? That Congress that we elected last year, elected to end the war in Iraq, which they haven't done, elected to hold people accountable for criminal acts, which they haven't done. And now, the icing on the cake for that Congress is that they are actively considering the Bush administration's request to give immunity to all of those corporations that did the illegal act of giving our information to the Bush administration. Well, so back to dear Catherine Gunn, the British citizen who was the listener, who knew what the rules were. Don't listen on British citizens. And it turned out that they were not supposed to be listening to the conversations of the member states of the UN Security Council. And when her supervisor came to her to say, the British government, the Blair government, has received a request from the Bush administration to assist them in listening in to the conversations of those member states of the UN Security Council. Little Catherine Gunn, young Catherine Gunn, said, I know what the rules are, and we don't do that stuff. We don't do it. And her supervisor said, well, we do now, because it's very important. The Bush administration needs to put great pressure on all of those member states to vote for war on Iraq, military operations on Iraq. And, you know, if the Bush administration sees that one country is not going to vote for it, they're going to really put pressure on them. They're going to pull economic support funds to that country. They're going to deny them military training opportunities. So we've got to help the Bush administration find out how they're going to vote. Well, Catherine Gunn said, this isn't right at all. So what do you think she did? Well, she took all of these little emails that she could find that had come from the Bush administration to the Blair administration. She's a Xerox copy of it, and she just mailed it to the British media, and they published it. Yeah. Well, now, did we hear about that? No. I mean, here is a big deal over in the UK. All of a sudden, this it was reveal that the British government were helping the Americans to eavesdrop on the UN Security Council. Well, Elizabeth Gunn, not Catherine Gunn, was charged with violating the Official Secrets Act of the UK. Charged with it. And for over a year, I mean, she was fired, she was arrested, she was charged. The case was going to trial. A year they were preparing, you know, to put her in jail for violating this Secrets Act. Well, the night before the case was to be argued, the British government folded its case. Just said, well, we've decided we won't prosecute. Well, I wonder why that was. Well, it turns out that somehow the defense had gotten a copy of Elizabeth Willemshurst, the former legal advisor to the Foreign Service. Her consistent advice to the Blair administration had been, if you invade and occupy Iraq, a country that has done nothing to the UK, that will be an act of aggression. It will be a war crime. A war crime. And you can be held responsible in an international criminal court. You, Tony Blair, you, Jack Straw, you can be held accountable. And indeed, that legal analysis was held by Lord Goldsmith, the UK Attorney General. His advice to the Blair administration for months had been, if we go to war based on what evidence we have here, this is war crime material. He changed his mind about 10 days before the war started. The legal analysis now of the UK Attorney General was, you will not be held accountable. That indeed there's a legal foundation for us to go to war. He came to that because of great political pressure put on him. Well, Elizabeth Willemshurst, though, in her letter of resignation, she had written all this stuff down. War of aggression, war crime, Lord Goldsmith has turned turtle on us. His advice has been all along, it's going to be a war crime, and then 10 days before the war, he changes his mind. Well, that was the letter that the defense apparently had and told the British government they were going to bring it out in court that Elizabeth Willemshurst had resigned over exactly the issue of war crimes of the Blair administration. And the British government went, maybe it's better to just fold the case on Catherine Gunn and keep that letter of resignation out of the public view. So they folded the case for Catherine, except six weeks later, guess what? Elizabeth's letter of resignation surfaced. And the British people then knew that there had been resignations because of the illegality of this war. And if you look at other things that the British government had done, I mean, how many of you heard of the Downing Street memos?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we didn't hear about them until real late after they had been published in the UK. We didn't hear about them until May of 2005. And yet they had been written in 2002. And this was the description by senior British officials, their ambassador to the US, their equivalent of their Minister of Defense, their CIA director equivalent, MI5 director, who had been approached by members of the Bush administration saying, we are going to war in Iraq. We're taking Saddam out and we need your help on it. And that stunned all of these senior officials of the British government. How in the world can you go to war when Saddam hasn't done anything to us? We've had no-fly zones over the country for the last 10 years. We've had a quarantine around the country for 10 years. How are you going to cook up some evidence that shows that there is an immediate threat to international security from Saddam Hussein? We'll have to fix the intelligence in order to do that. Well, indeed, that's what started happening. The intelligence started to be fixed, and we see one of the great examples of it in the presentation that Secretary of State Colin Powell gave in February of 2003 to the UN Security Council. Remember that 2 hours that he was there with the photographs of drones that could drop chemical stuff, of trucks that were seen at this location and then they were gone and then they were at this location. I mean, the whole story of what he was using to try to convince the UN Security Council members and us that there was a real threat from Saddam Hussein, except that he was lying. He was lying. So it's important that we have whistleblowers that are out there, whistleblowers that are willing to stand up. Whistleblowers like Bunatine Greenhouse, the chief contracting officer of the Army Corps of Engineers, who blew the whistle on her own organization for issuing sole source, multi-billion dollar contracts in the lead off to the war in Iraq. And we know who got those billion dollar contracts. Vice President Cheney's Halliburton Company did. And Bunatine Greenhouse stood up to her own organization saying, that's wrong, it's breaking all of our rules. And even in times of crisis, in times of war, we are strong enough that we can move the system and still protect the interests of the people of the United States and their pocketbook. There's no reason to have sole source bids. We can have competitive bids among the companies that we know that are capable of doing these missions. We can send out these contract proposals quickly and we can get their bids in and then we can have a real bidding process on it. But that's not what was done. And so what happened to Bunatine? Well, from going from the senior contracting officer of this massive organization, the Army Corps of Engineers, they tried to fire her, they tried to make her resign, they tried to retire her. And fortunately, people that she'd worked with along these many years she'd worked with the Corps of Engineers came to her rescue, including the previous head of the Army Corps of Engineers. So she's hanging on by her fingernails. She's still in the Army Corps of Engineers. But it seems like her only, she doesn't really do anything there. They won't give her any work. But she does respond to requests by the U.S. Congress. When congressional committees call for whistleblower hearings on contracting in Iraq, guess who's the number one witness? Bunatine Greenhouse, standing right there. We have other people that have spoken out, military people. You know, you kind of think, well, you know, the military, you sign the dotted line, salute, and that's it. But we know that's not true. We know it's not. Most of the people who have really taken the acts of courage, though, are not our senior officers, our four-star generals, who get paid big bucks to be professional and honest, to give honest evaluations to the senior policymakers of our country. But I'm afraid we've been failed by virtually all of them, that they became toadies, that they were unwilling to stand up to Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld, who said, we're going to have a high-tech war in Iraq. We don't need 500,000 people going in to invade and occupy that country. We can do it with just a couple of 100,000. And yet we did have one person that stood up. That was a four-star general, the chief of staff of the Army, Eric Shinseki, who, when he was asked in a congressional hearing, these war plans that we have, are they sufficient? Will they cover the obligations of the United States as an occupying power? Shinseki said, honestly, no. We're missing a couple of 100,000 soldiers. Well, oh, I'm sure Donald Rumsfeld was very pleased to hear that. Yeah, well, what happened to Shinseki? He was cut off at the knees on that one. He was essentially retired in place. The last year of his service to the country as chief of staff of one of the four army, or one of the four military organizations that we have, the Army. He was sidelined because he dared speak the truth to Rumsfeld. Another person who dared speak truth was a specialist who was handed a CD that had a lot of photographs from Abu Ghraib. Those 19 famous photographs, that infamous photographs that showed the horrible treatment, the humiliating treatment, the torture that was done to men and women that were held in the Abu Ghraib prison. A lot of people knew what was going on in Abu Ghraib, but nobody said anything. Until Specialist Joe Darby took this CD filled with those pictures and he gave it to the Criminal Investigative Office of his unit. And that office looked at him and went, this is big trouble. We've got to alert the chain of command what's happening. Well, Joe Darby was still in Iraq, sitting at a mess hall table when Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld came on CNN. And it was being broadcast in Joe's mess hall. And he was sitting there eating his lunch when all of a sudden Rumsfeld said, "Yes, we do have a situation in Iraq that's causing us concern. There appears that there were abuses that were done in Abu Ghraib prison. And we know about this because Specialist Joe Darby gave us the information." Essentially in that sort of tone. Well, Joe was sitting there eating his lunch and went, "Oh my God." And his buddies that were at the table, some of whom were involved in those abuses, looked over at Darby. "Oh, you squealed. Boy, you're in trouble." Well, Joe knew that his lifespan probably staying in Iraq was going to be pretty short. So he immediately went to his chain of command and said, I gave those photographs to CID, and I think my life's in danger here." And his commanding officer recognized that too, and they got him out of the country that night. He never went home though, because by that time his home in West Virginia, the people in his little town had heard that same CNN broadcast, and they had already gone to the homes of Joe's family to say, "Your son's a traitor. Your son's unpatriotic. We're going to get your son when he comes home." So Joe and his family are now under federal protective custody. They have new lives in new parts of the country because of his stand of courage. We have other people in the military, though, men and women who have served in Iraq many times and have come back and have said, "I've seen what's going on there, and I think it's wrong. And I can no longer in good conscience go back to Iraq." And many of them went AWOL. They left their unit. And some have returned to military custody voluntarily to subject themselves to a military court-martial. We've had about 30 of them who have returned voluntarily and have been court-martialed and have been given sentences anywhere from 2 months to 15 months in jail for having said, "I cannot kill. I cannot do what you're ordering me to do." We have one, Aaron Watada, who is the commissioned officer who last year said, or in 2006, said, "I cannot go to Iraq. It is a war of aggression. It's illegal. I cannot go. I cannot accept what you are giving me, which is an unlawful order." And several of us were at his first court-martial in Fort Lewis, Washington, that ended in a mistrial. And now Aaron, the Army is debating whether to try him again, to court-martial him a second time. However, the federal courts have stepped in to say to the Army, "You must make a decision. You, the Army, must decide whether or not charging him with this, or trying him for those same charges that the mistrial occurred on. You've got to rule whether or not that's double jeopardy or not." And the federal courts have said you cannot do anything until you make that ruling. And now we're at it's almost 4 months since the federal court told the Army that, and there's been no movement on it. So it's unclear what's going to happen, whether the Army will go ahead and court-martial him, but the federal courts will protect him until they make that decision. He could stay in jail up to 6 years for refusing an order to go to Iraq. We have other men and women who have said, "I should not have to even undergo a court-martial. I'm going to Canada. I feel that this war is illegal, and I'm just going up there, and I'll stay up there until somebody gives amnesty." There are several hundred men and women that are up there now from our military. The Canadian government, unlike during Vietnam, when a soldier would go across the border and immediately ask for political asylum and be granted it, the Harper government and the government before has made a new ruling that only refugee status is available to, the application for refugee status is available for soldiers, military that are in Canada. Two of our soldiers, the first two that went into Canada, have been pushing their refugee application all the way up through the Canadian court system. And just a couple of weeks ago, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled that they are not eligible for refugee status. So now Amnesty International has said that all American soldiers then that are in Canada should be considered prisoners of conscience, because if they are returned to the United States, they will be charged with desertion, and the ultimate penalty for that can be execution. So that now qualifies them to be called prisoners of conscience for amnesty. Now there's a great movement with Courage to Resist leading the floor on that, working with the Canadian government, the Canadian parliamentarians, to see if the Canadians won't change their approach to servicemen and women from the United States who say that this is an illegal war. I mean, the Canadian government's not participating in the war in Iraq. They, as a national decision, refuse to participate in the war in Iraq. They are participating in Afghanistan, but they're not in Iraq. So if you have any extra time, any extra money, go on the Courage to Resist website. There are plenty of ways that you can help move a message to Canadian parliamentarians to help us out. And while you're speaking to those Canadian parliamentarians, let me ask you to add one little thing to your letter. I have a little bone to pick with Canada right now. You know, the whole issue of civil liberties. Would you say that your civil liberties are stronger or weaker than they were before 9/11? How about a little weaker? Yeah. Well, one of the points that I put in my letter of resignation was that I was resigning because of the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties in the United States under the Patriot Act. Well, little did I know that I would find what that really meant. I have been arrested several different times, probably 15 times in the last 2.5 years, for peaceful, nonviolent protest of administration policies. I've been arrested in front of the White House, and arrested in the Congress, and arrested in Crawford, arrested in San Francisco, arrested in New York. I mean, they're just good targets of opportunity all over the place. And in fact, okay, everybody, close your eyes, don't look around, but how many people have been arrested? Arrested, going to jail for justice. Okay, good. Let's have a... Not that arrest is the cure-all for anything, but quite honestly, if you all haven't seen the inside of the jails as a prisoner, then you have some work to do on your whole social justice outlook, because until you see the insides of those jails and those prisons, you really can't fathom how badly our judicial and penal systems are working right now. When we have, I think, government and corporate orchestrated plan to increase the number of people that are incarcerated in our country, because now so many prisons are privatized. I come from Hawaii, and we ship all sorts of prisoners to private prisons on the mainland, because the rules are now that, I mean, 3 strikes you're out, 2 strikes you're out, 1 strike you're out. I mean, lots of people are going to jail for minor stuff, and the prisons, the jails are just so overcrowded. And you need to see it to believe it. You really do. And to see what pressures that puts on men and women who perhaps have broken a law, done a misdemeanor, done a minor felony, or something like that. But what we're doing to them ensures that they will not have a chance to ever climb out of the hole that we are putting them in. So with that, I would say, consider. Not only standing up to protest Bush policies, but if you have to, go ahead and go to jail and not think anything about it, except I'm going to be in there to investigate what's going on with fellow citizens in that prison. It's really something that we need to do for ourselves. But anyway, okay, I've had my little bout with regulations, ordinances, peaceful nonviolent protest, misdemeanor convictions, and lo and behold, I find myself on the FBI's National Crime Information Center database. And this is supposed to be for, you know, sexual offenders, for foreign fugitives, for members of violent gangs, for, you know, really tough, mean people that have really broken bad laws. And not for, I didn't think, for people that were just standing in the wrong place in front of the White House and refused to move, or would go into a congressional hearing and when they heard something they didn't like, just to stand up and say to Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, who was testifying with General Petraeus, that I am a diplomat, I'm a diplomat too, but I'm a diplomat for peace, and you can't have peace through occupation. We need to end the occupation in Iraq, and we need to bring our troops home. And for that, I got arrested and convicted, but of a misdemeanor. And yet now I find myself on this list. Or actually, I didn't find myself on the list. I didn't know I was on it. It was the Canadians that found me on the list. I'd gone to Canada to participate in a conference up there on prosperity and security. And this is the code word that the administrations of the U.S., the Canadians, and the Mexicans are using to have an agreement that's not a treaty, because that would they'd have to bring it to the light of day and have it go through the U.S. Congress. This is an agreement from the executives that will really alter the way our government works in relation to other governments, that there are security enhancements that are going on, that the Bush administration is forcing the Canadians and the Mexicans to adhere to, one of which is that the Canadians have to use the FBI's National Crime Information Center database. So if you happen to get on it here in the U.S., and I would say the reason I'm on it is for political intimidation. I mean, they want to silence dissent. They don't want people out in front of the White House causing them trouble. They don't want us in the halls of Congress. They don't want us out at Crawford, Texas, standing up there to embarrass the president that there are citizens that say, end this war in Iraq. So how are they going to silence it? Well, one of the ways is constrict your freedom to travel, so that you get in an awkward predicament when you've made plans to go to a conference or you've made plans to go visit friends or relatives, and all of a sudden you can't go because your name's on an American list that the Canadians are using. Well, the Canadian parliamentarians are just as upset about it as I am. Unfortunately, not many of our U.S. congressmen and women seem to be much upset about it at all. I'm not getting any help on trying to find out from the FBI who ordered them to put this type of crime, misdemeanor, on that list. Who ordered it? When did it happen? What categories of things are they putting on? Are they doing it for everyone here? Or is it just people that are protesting the administration's policies? So these are questions that we are really grappling with right now. It's a lot of intimidation that's going on right now to people that are standing up against this administration. And I know that you are out on the corners every single day. You're with the vigils. You're whenever there's a national mobilization. If you can't make it to Washington, you're for sure doing it in your local areas. And sometimes the police crack down a little bit more than maybe other times. It's interesting that one of the things to ask your local law enforcement, if you arrest me for this misdemeanor violation, are you sending that to the FBI? Has the FBI asked you to report on me, on my conviction? It's something worth fighting, every one of these, to go to a court and say, I want to have a trial by my peers, because the ramifications of what's going on right now are very severe, that this administration is putting us in a category that can limit our freedom of travel. But that's the price it is not the price we have to pay. It is the price that we have to fight against. And we will not pay that price. I mean, we will fight them tooth and nail on this. And we will do what we have to protect those civil liberties that are the foundation of our government. These men and women that are in this book from the U.S., from the U.K., from Australia, from Denmark, who have stood up to their governments, are people that, the reason we wrote the book is to give people hope and to read this thing and say, holy smoke, if that person could do that, I sure as heck can get out there on that street. One of the folks who was so kind to write a little portion, or we just wanted him to write the foreword for the book, and that was Dan Ellsberg, as a big whistleblower. Well, it was 2 days before the book was to go to press, and Dan's little two paragraphs still hadn't gotten in, and so we were emailing him and calling. He's busy, he's traveling all over the place, he's writing articles, and finally we got to him, and he said, "Oh my God, you mean it's that close? Just a few hours? Oh, I'll send you some. I'm doing it right now." Well, 6 hours later, here came this, it wasn't just a couple of paragraphs, it turned out to be a chapter. It was a chapter that is in this book from Dan Ellsberg on what he feels, why he feels the men and women in this book, who are just a representative sample of hundreds, thousands of men and women that are speaking up. But I just wanted to read you one little part of this, because I love this part. Dan says, "This is a book that should be leaked into the government. I would like to see it in digital form, hacked in its entirety, into every personal computer in the Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, NSA, CIA, and FBI. Is there someone out there who could do that? It would be a marvelously subversive act, because nothing really is more subversive than the shameful silence of the Congress and the American public within those institutions, the tolerance of dishonesty and manipulation, the complicity by those who know better with wrongful policies that endanger lives and our constitutional order. We might even avoid a repetition in Iran of the horrors those public servants saw coming in Iraq and did their very best to avert." So with that, I want to thank you all so very much here in Santa Cruz for being the voices of conscience in your community, for being out there day in and day out, week in and week out, and it's hard. But have hope. We are going to end this war. We are going to hold people accountable for the criminal acts they've done, and we'll do it because you all want it to be done. So thank you very much.